Hello, faithful listeners, and welcome to a Doctor Who Target Files special episode. Over the most recent weekend, as I record this on the 27th of September 2016, myself and co-presenter Alex Gibbons attended the Regenerations Convention in Swansea. Lucky enough to be given a number of minutes, half an hour in fact, by the editor of Doctor Who magazine, Tom Spilsbury himself. So we have that interview here in this special episode for you all to enjoy, in which we discuss the Target range of books with Tom, his love of other films, TV and music in general, and just have a nice social chat really. So here we go, here it is for you to enjoy, listeners.
Any thoughts on the Target range? Any nostalgic memories of them?
Very much so, because I put it in a bit of context. I'm 40, I was born in 1976. And as far back as I can remember, you know, I had Target books because my dad was a Doctor Who fan anyway. You know, he was a young man in his 20s when Doctor Who started. So he bought the books before I was even born. Yeah. So I was sort of born into an environment where there were already books on my shelf as I came into the world.
Wow.
I think it, as an incentive, what he did when I started sort of, you know, going to school and so on, you know, as an incentive to get to be up in good time in the morning and ready for school and all of that, you know, I would get a he would take one of the Target books from his shelf, and it would move to my shelf, so it would go from his bedroom to my bedroom. So gradually, you know, the whole collection sort of transferred over.
Excellent.
This was his little bribe to make sure that I was you know, well behaved, always ready for school on time in the mornings. Obviously, there were new ones coming out too, because the ones that would have already been there would have been the 70s books. But by the time I'm really remembering, the new ones as they came would have been sort of, I suppose, by about 1980,
yes,
81. Yeah. So I specifically remember one time, you know, being collected from school by my dad. You know, he came to collect me. And he'd been to George's Bookshop in Bristol, and there was a copy, I think it must have been State of Decay, which was... check this, because I think it may have been the first one with the neon logo, you know, with the pink logo and the blue background, the illustration. And this was particularly exciting because obviously it was one of the stories that I remember watching quite recently at that point, you know, and I, you know, there was always that thing about being able to revisit a story which otherwise you couldn't revisit. You know, we didn't have a video recorder then. And with all of the others, they were stories which I didn't know at all. But this was one I was familiar with, and it had the new logo and so on. And then, you know, others followed. I certainly remember, I think, one by the birthday or Christmas. You know, I got the Leisure Hive, and they were sort of building up. And obviously, by that point, I think, you know, most of the previous Tom Baker series, they, you know, been put out by Terrence, they were already on my shelf. I remember the Sun Makers being sort of the last one, or of the Tom Baker run, because it came out, it was that odd exception where it didn't fit with the others, because it came out with the newer neon logo, even
yes,
though it was one of the older books. And when I saw that in the bookshop, by this point I was a little bit older again, and, you know, in George's Bookshop in Bristol, and seeing that one there and thinking, well, I don't know what that is, because I hadn't realised that there was still one that they hadn't put out from the Tom Baker run. Well, actually, I suppose it's a small one, because there was Pirate Planet and City of Death, but I kind of knew they hadn't come out. I think even then I must have gathered that they would Douglas Adams. I was, you know, I'm still quite small by this point, but I knew my facts in that way.
So you were in Doctor Who by then?
Well, because my earliest memory of actually watching Doctor Who was Destiny of the Daleks in 1979, when I was about 3 and a half, and that's also, of course, round about the period when the magazine started. Doctor Who Weekly started that autumn. So very strong memories of watching that and getting the early issues of the Weekly and sort of everything from there on. So it's quite probable, actually, that I was in the room even younger watching there. But, my, you know, there's only so far back your memory goes, isn't there?
Yeah, totally.
I wouldn't be surprised if from birth I was, you know, sitting on my mum or my dad's lap as Dad was watching Doctor Who. I was born in the middle of the Seeds of Doom, so I probably saw that a week old.
Any standout books for you or
standout books? I specifically remember, I really liked reading the Tom Baker era ones, so I remember the real classics, but Brain of Morbius was a novelisation I really enjoyed reading.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
When you were looking at them, was it the sort of colour that drew you to them?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, every Doctor Who fan can sort of know the sequence of colours along the spikes on your shelf. So, and some of them, you know, the Brain of Morbius with that yellow cover and then that terrific illustration of Tom Baker and the Solemn of Morbius in the sort of the lower section as well. You know, all of those illustrated covers, I mean, they were all, I like staring at so many of them. You know, the red and the illustration of Genesis, which I put on the cover of the magazine earlier this year, because again, it's a particular favourite. I remember the Deadly Assassin novelisation cover was particularly scary to my younger brother, which of course I delighted in being sort of waving it in his face, because it's horrific, isn't it, with the really sort of the face of the master, kind of that sort of dripping red. Whatever it is, it's strange because that's not quite how it is in the episode, but it was a sort of artistic
left of the imagination.
Where it's all sort of melting or something, like candle wax.
Do you think sometimes that the books are better than TV episodes in the Target era?
Well, I think sometimes, particularly where you've read the book first, so it's all in your imagination. You know, you're just looking at the plot and the story and the dialogue, and so you're not looking at a wonky performance or set or whatever it might be. That, you know, so there are fewer elements in that sense. You can just look at the words. So I think particularly when you come to that first, you know, you do build up your own impression of it, which can then be better than perhaps the reality when years later you look at the actual story. So I think that's possibly true in a lot of cases. Even stories which I love on TV, the novelizations can be, inverted commas, better.
Yes.
But the truth is they're just different, aren't they? It's a different medium.
It's the way you look at it, really, isn't it? It's all changed when you read the book to the movie. Which ones would you say come off better in the book than TV?
There are some which really are at pains to go into a lot more detail, aren't there?
Yeah.
I love Terror of the Autons. Am I thinking of that? Or maybe the other one, the Auton Invasion. I think that, but maybe both.
Very expanded.
Auton Invasion does expand it.
Yeah, very expanded.
On Spearhead from Space. I think there was a point, wasn't there, where Terrence was doing a lot and they became quite perfunctory.
Yes.
We've been fucked for the last couple of weeks.
Reading off a page, yeah.
Very A to B books, unfortunately.
When I saw Terrence speak in Aberystwyth about 2 years ago, now at a BAFTA Cymru event, and he more or less admitted he was churning them out for the cash
I think he said that himself, but I mean, I love them just the same. I mean, I remember the novelisation of The Five Doctors, because again, obviously, The Five Doctors, wow, what a terrific adventure for a 7-year-old, as I was at the time, and then being able to, I just read it over and over. I mean, on a Sunday afternoon, if I could just read the whole book in one sitting, then I would go up to my bedroom and do that. That was one I definitely read over and over. Because it's The Five Doctors, isn't it? You know, with its lovely silver cover and the very unusual cover, that one, wasn't it? Didn't
that's
really look
one
like
that's
any
stuck
others.
In my memory, yes. The silhouettes, wasn't it? The five faces.
I mean, there was a point where I decided I was going to read them all in order, because, of course, I sort of read them in a bit of a piggledy-piggledy order at first. And then there was a point where I decided, because you couldn't read them all in order at first anyway, because there were plenty that hadn't come out. You know, we were waiting years to get some of the early Hartnell serials novelised.
Yeah, we reviewed The Edge of Destruction recently, and that didn't come out until 1987, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I think things like, well, some of the really late ones were like the Power and Evil novelisations, weren't they? They were into the 90s. There were some of those Dalek ones that didn't come out for quite a while. I was thinking it was a shame, because maybe that's why, I mean, I reread Genesis and Destiny of the Daleks, and some of the other, because actually, obviously, I love Daleks, and there were a lot of them weren't available as books. You know, you couldn't get The Chase, you couldn't get Master Plan, couldn't get Power Evil, you couldn't get Resurrection, Revelation. Remembrance was before it probably even been made at that point. So there were quite rare commodities, some of that. Now, this might be sacrilege. I could never quite get into the original Dalek novelisation, because it put me off that it had a different opening.
We thought it was better. I think
looking at it now with adult eyes, but I think it's a beautifully written book, and really, I mean, it was the first one. one, wasn't it? It was the very first one. So, of course, particularly people who were a little older than me who remember that as being the only book, you know, I think loved it and cherished it and reread it and so on. But there was something about the fact that it was all written in the first person which put me off. It was just a taste thing at the time. I didn't like how it didn't fit with the others, which, of course, is a very Doctor Who fan thing. We like like things to fit, don't we? I sort of struggled a bit with that.
I feel that was given a new lease of life by the audiobook releases.
Yeah.
Because William Russell reads it so superbly.
In character as him doing... Yes. Because it is the only one I'm saying, which is sort of written as though it's written by Ian, isn't it?
Yeah,
Because the other early ones, with like the Zabi and...
Crusade,
yeah. You know, they rather charmingly refer to the character as Doctor Who throughout and so on. But I don't mean they're written from... Ian's perspective. I wonder whether that decision was conscious, a choice that was, that we're going to change it now. Because I suppose there would have come a point where it couldn't always be Ian, because Ian leaves anyway, so it would have to have changed.
Because they were, those three originals were Target books before Target existed, weren't they?
They weren't Target. It did them, and then later Target had acquired them. When they were sort of starting the reign. And by which point, of course, it made more sense to be doing a lot of Pertwee stories as he was the current Doctor at the time. You know, the Demons was probably quite early. I can't remember the precise order, but these were the ones with the more basic logo just in black.
Have you got any sort of surprise that they haven't brought them back for the new series? You know, just perhaps maybe they could have, in the 50th anniversary year, brought out a few just...
Well,
the original writers, if possible.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I know that it has occasionally been... brought up by people. In a sense, because when they were being brought out, this isn't a time before videos and being able to rewatch them the same way. It's like every film used to have a novelisation. I used to have the film novelisation of Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, and Batman.
Same,
they don't really do that now either.
I read
Back
to the Future 2 and 3 before they came out in the cinema.
Me too.
Yeah.
I always loved the books because sometimes you'd watch a film and the book made much more sense than the film you just watched.
And even The Phantom Menace came
out. Sometimes, yes, you'd find that they would perhaps be a purer version in a sense. Before it's been mucked around by in an edit to chop bits out or whatever. So, but I think I'm right in saying, I may be wrong, nothing really tends to get novelised much these days. Maybe occasionally.
I did hear a rumour, you can shoot this down if you want to, that Mark Gatiss at one point was considering novelising The Crimson Horror.
I think he may have said so. Yeah, I mean, there was also, I think, a talk with Neil Gaiman doing The Doctor's Wife, but I think he wanted to do his version of it rather than the version that got rewritten by Steve.
Right, that would have been interesting.
And obviously, they kind of... I don't know what happened there, but it didn't happen anyway. I think there was then talk we could do Nightmare in Silver, but nobody really wanted Nightmare in Silver.
No, fair enough.
They did do a couple of Sarah Jane novelisations.
Terence did the first one, didn't he, Terence
Sticks?
They were actually quite good, though.
I think it's tricky because obviously there's so many that came out. I'm not sure you could pick odd ones, but it's not like I think at this point it would be really practical to go and do everything. You know, it would have been lovely, I think, for example, to have a sort of Day of the Doctor novelization. You know, sort of the obvious ones. Rose would be obvious, but I mean, I suppose the key thing was that obviously Russell was busy working on the actual show. You know, for the first 4 or 5 years, and fair enough, if anyone was going to do it, he didn't really want someone else to go and
do it.
So I guess it kind of all became a bit sort of, you know, maybe impractical. Or I mean, I don't know whether you've spoken to anyone from BBC Books about this. About this topic, you should ask them for their view. I mean, personally, I'd love to see them, but that's partly the nostalgia talking, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
It's down to money, really, isn't it, as well, I suppose.
Well, I do wonder whether I'd sort of sit there reading a novelisation of Fear Her, or whether I'd just put it on the shelf and not actually look at it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it is that sort of...
But then there's the opportunity as well to make stories more expansive, perhaps better received.
Well, one of the things I was sort of look forward to, sometimes there'd be stories where I didn't fully understand it. I remember talking about Warrior's Gate or something, it was quite small, and my dad sort of say, I said, this would always be a stock response, I'm sure they'll explain it all in the novelisation, you know, anything that was a bit more complicated, you know. Then there was that opportunity, wasn't there, to clarify certain things. There's clearly some novelisations where something hasn't really come across well on the screen. you know, so you can do that. I mean, there's some wonderful ones that are expanded. Later on, of course, you know, we were talking about the early ones, but later on I think things like Remembrance of the Daleks is a terrific adaptation, which really expands on the on what was on screen.
Well, that is our next review, isn't it? That's our next one.
I think that has to do with Ben Aronovitz, where he's a much better writer than screenwriter, I think.
Well, also, those Seventh Doctor serials, I think virtually all of them, except, funnily enough, Battlefield, which Ben Aronovitz had started, they're all written by their original author as well, aren't they? So that's the only era which Terence doesn't get a look in on, because all the original authors.
But it did need to evolve, and it became sort of the New Adventures, I suppose, isn't it?
But I mean,
floating into that.
That's right, and I think all of those Seventh Doctor books. I mean, I'm a great fan of the era on television, but I think it was also a real changing period, because of course it does start to lead into the era of the New Adventures and longer stories, and I think that those novelizations are starting to go in that direction as well.
It did seem to be a lot bigger books when you brought a New Adventure to a Target. Yeah. You know, you didn't have that 100 page set of New Adventure, and there's a lot more space for adult characters to grow, basically.
Yes, I think so. And I mean, I was also a reader of the New Adventures when they came along, so you did have that sort of thing about having to imagine again. Whereas if I was reading a novelisation of the Happiness Patrol, I knew what it looked like, you know. So the New Adventures were recapturing in a way that thing I'd had when I was much younger, of not knowing quite what it looked like, you know. So I think that's the thing. As for novelising the current ones, I mean, well, there is that sort of sense that the reason for them has disappeared, I suppose, but it would be nice to have some one-offs.
It would be nice to just encourage reading again in children, wouldn't it, I think?
Well, I mean, BBC Books does publish books which I think of.
That's what I'm wondering with the way things are. You just pick and download and put things on your iPad these days. Would there be the market for it there?
Well, I think, again, you should just speak to someone at BBC Books and get their impression. I mean, of course, they have reissued some of the older ones in recent times. So, I mean, of course, that's reprints. So it's you know, books which have already been written. But they have gone back, of course, and done the Douglas Adams stories.
Yes, yeah.
So there have been new novelisations, albeit of older stories.
Yes.
I mean, a big part of that is because Douglas Adams is a name which you can put very large on a book cover.
Yeah,
that will sell.
Yeah, but you know, they're good reads, aren't they?
Would you say, with DWM, would you say the audience has changed to more younger than nostalgia now?
What, the audience of the magazine?
Or Who in general, you know, from your sort of magazine sales, would you say it's younger now?
Well, I suppose when you get... Yes and no, I mean... On the one hand, yes, of course, there are younger people coming in, but as there always were at any point, you know, there are people, you know, but maybe it stopped a bit when it wasn't on TV because not as many younger people were coming to it. On the other hand, of course, we're all getting a year older every year, so yeah. I do look at our when we do the season survey and we ask people's age, and every year the average age seems to get about a year older. And I think there's probably a reason for that, isn't there? That we're all getting a year older every year, you know. And of course, it's slightly less than one because we are getting some younger people coming in and maybe some older people. The far end sort of shuffling off, so slightly it's not going up quite that, but it's, I think, you know, obviously, I mean, when we do the magazine, we have to be mindful of the fact that there are younger readers, but of course we don't have to be specifically for children, because there are, you know, Doctor Who Adventures is specifically there to be for children, but it was always like that, wasn't it? I mean, if you're an intelligent child, you're always wanting to look at things which actually are probably aimed slightly older.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and that was the case with, you know, reading the magazine or reading the books. You know, even if I struggled on some of the longer words, you know, I was always lucky because my dad was a fan, so we'd read together and he would explain words if I didn't understand what they were when I was only, you know, 6 years old.
Yes.
A lot of learning and words or encountering words for the first time came through Doctor Who in one form or another.
Some of the stories.
Yeah.
Some of the wording.
If you look at this stuff, absolutely. You don't ever want to sort of dumb down, do you?
No, very true.
or just assume that people won't get it. I mean, funnily enough, we were having a conversation about Doctor Who Adventures the other day, which I'm not really directly involved in, because, you know, but about what sort of level of language you can put in terms of words of more than one syllable.
And I
think you can do it, because Doctor Who always appeal to intelligent kids, you know, who want to, you know, Doctor Who is a programme which has longer words in it, so why wouldn't you put those into a magazine which is aimed at children?
Excellent. Well, it's on a bit more fun though, Tom. What was the last film, TV, music thing you bought or saw?
TV, film or music?
Yeah. Any three of the mediums.
Well, shall I go for all three of those?
TV...
I'm revisiting some old things at the moment, because I've been watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine through with my
parents. Same here. I've been doing Trek all this year for the 50th.
I've actually got the DVD, so I've been doing it through that, because I've had those on my shelf for ages. But I'm watching those with my dad, because he never watched them 20 years ago when they were new. So now he's just sort of finally got around to it, you know, and we're watching together. Because it's always nice to watch. If you're re-watching something, I think it's always nice to watch with someone who doesn't already know it, because you get an extra enjoyment through them being surprised by
I think things. DS9 is my favourite too.
Oh, it's a terrific show. Absolutely fantastic.
I need to watch it again, because I watched it the first time, didn't really get it all, and I was at the age of more the Next Generation.
The truncated BBC schedule of those days, yeah.
Well, I mean, the Next Generation obviously was the one which sort of brought Star Trek back into the mainstream in that way, and I think it's got some terrific stuff, but I do feel, particularly when it gets going, and DS9 gets going quicker than the Next Generation does. I think all of those shows take a little while, but DS9, I think, gets it quicker than the others. And when it gets to, certainly, the fourth, fifth, sixth series, they're telling stories which I think are just phenomenal, and it's the way it becomes more serialised. I mean, I can't sing its praises highly enough, really. I love it. So that's one thing I'm revisiting.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the new episode of Goodnight Sweetheart that the BBC put
earlier.
Same here.
It needs a series.
I'd like to see a new series. That, funnily enough, because, of course, that original run of Goodnight Sweetheart was exactly the time Star Trek Deep Space Nine was, 93 to 99.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, gosh, I can't believe how much time has passed since these things. So I was having a look at some of the old
really
ones. Do you
believe Nick Clinton's character now? Because we've had that gap. Because technology's changed
idea
so much.
Yeah, of someone from 1999.
Going to 2016.
Who that's, in a sense, the present day has stopped at that point.
Yes.
And everything else has moved on without him. Actually, I thought was a lovely twist, which is quite kind of, it's obvious, is what you have to do. Yes. It's built into the format. But it's very neatly reverses the original concept that he's now out of time in the present.
In his own time.
Of course, his own time really is now the 1960s.
Yeah.
So
did you find it? Did you enjoy it from the start of the episode? Because I thought it got better, and that's what I liked. Yeah, it got better as you watched it.
Well, I was always fond of the show, so I don't know. I don't know how well it might have worked for anyone who'd never seen it before, because you kind of need to accept the premise. Oh, he was someone who did this back in the 90s, and then he got stuck there, and all the rest of it. And it was never a show I found which was, given that it is a sitcom, it was as much about the drama of it than it was about jokes, in a way.
Yes.
Yeah, the jokes always seem to be the back part of it. That's what I think is good with a good sitcom. You need that laughter, but
yeah.
You need pathos.
You had very good dramatic actors, didn't you? You had Dave LeCurwin to start with, you had Nicholas Lyndhurst.
I agree. Yeah, I think, again, as a result of that new one, I've watched some of the old ones. Dave LeCurwin's a fantastic actress. You know, she's really, really good. And that's not to denigrate Elizabeth Carlin, who came in later, who's also very good. But you know, it struck me that Dave LeCurwin's doing a performance which it would be absolutely fitting in a drama. She's not doing sitcom acting. I don't mean anyone's doing sitcom acting apart from maybe, I mean, Reg is a more sitcom-y character, I suppose, and Ron, they're sort of the comic relief in the two time periods. But actually, there's something rather sort of sad about the whole thing in some ways, because you've got this situation where these people are in the start of the Second World War, and sort of without hope.
Yeah.
That sort of, they don't. Gary comes in and knows that you know, eventually it's all going to work out fine. So we can sort of breeze in and out, knowing that eventually we'll win the war. These people who are living in fear that Hitler and, you know, will win and that they could be invaded at some point. Yes. You know, the Blitz is happening and their homes are being bombed. Just that sort of, you know, this is... I mean, I know it's not the only sitcom set during a war, because you've got Dad's Army and Hello, Hello, you know, that those things. But it struck me that Goodnight Sweetheart actually did it in a far more realistic way. Yeah. Actually looking at how it affected these people. Despite being ostensibly a comedy.
But it has that a lot of darkness. I think it does have quite dark moments, I think. And it should come back. I don't know if the Beatles are going to bring it
back. Well, it would be a very different show. That's the nice thing, isn't it? Now it would be set in the 60s, which is a very different time.
And you've also got that great sort of thing between his daughter, he knew nothing about.
I think surely there must be the potential to do something.
I think out of that season of sitcoms, I think that was their intention to find.
Well, it's the only one, of course, which was a proper return with the cast that we'd had before and a continuation in that way. So it kind of worked.
The only one out of the whole lot I actually bothered to watch, because I enjoyed it when it was originally on. Yeah. I thought, I want to watch this to see if it's as good. And it was.
Yes. Yeah. So that's another thing then. Yeah. What were the other ones? Films.
Film music.
I used to go and see recently at the cinema. There's been a couple of things I wanted to see and haven't got around to.
Yeah, like me.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of these films, so I can tell the films that I wanted to see and haven't. The BFG is one. I wanted to see Ghostbusters, didn't see that.
I did enjoy Ghostbusters.
I almost went to go and see the new Star Trek film, but I just...
I loved it.
I have seen that. That was awesome. Okay. Very good.
If you're a fan of Star Trek, you will love it.
I have a slight problem with the rebooted Star Trek, but it's one that I know is a matter of taste.
What's the problem?
Well, only in the sense that I can't quite get over the fact that they're not the actual characters.
Yeah,
because
I know what you mean.
You know, it's that sort of thing. The first time I saw a picture of the new actors as Kirk and Spock,
I
thought they looked like a bunch of cosplayers. Do you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, Shatner and Nimoy and DeForest Kelly, they don't look like cosplayers because they are the originals, even though obviously they're dressed exactly the same. So, I mean, I know this is a superficial thing in a sense, but there's a...
But in the new film, I think they do become like Pine.
Right.
Has his own definitive stamp on Kirk now. Definitely in this film.
I mean, going briefly back to Star Trek there, but I mean, what I really want to see with Star Trek, and so I've been waiting a long time, is to see what happens next after Deep Space Nine and...
Yeah.
Discovery.
Yeah, well, they're not doing that, though, are they? I think they're going back to another the original series.
Anthology,
and I've never been someone who is interested particularly in prequels. It's like, because there's always that sense that, well, we know it works out okay, because we've already seen what happens afterwards. Yeah. So I want to know what happens in the Star Trek universe after, you know, 20 years or more, if you like, after Deep Space Nine and Voyager. What happens to the Dominion and the Klingons and the Cardassians and all of that? Something else again. But I think there's always the sense that if you're doing it 10 years before the original, there's that kind of feeling that...
Where are you going to leave it? It's like the Rogue One Star Wars now. How they're literally saying that is going to end 10 minutes before the start of Episode 4.
Right. Yeah. Well,
that's what they said. So,
I'm not a Star Wars fan in the same way. Although I admire it as a hugely successful, fantastic.
I am on a knot. I fell out of love with it, and I've sort of fell back in love with it with Force Awakening because it was that good.
Well, the funny thing is, I saw that film I saw recently. Yeah, the Star Wars film. I think I said somewhere it's about.
Nick Briggs, didn't you say it was not that great? I think you asked him the same sort of question, didn't you?
Who said that?
Nick Briggs. Go on to the podcast and I think you just seen it then, haven't you?
Yeah, I forget when I did that. Yeah, I think I had just seen it. And I think the way I put it rather diplomatically, I may have said this on Twitter or something, I said, I think it's exactly as good as every other Star Wars film I've ever seen. Because actually, I don't really distinguish. I mean, it's like that sort of thing when someone isn't a fan.
Yeah.
It's like, this is just a matter of taste. People who don't particularly like Doctor Who, so they're not going to particularly say whether one episode is better, because they're all identical as far as they're concerned.
Exactly.
And that's sort of how I see Star Wars. I think, well, it was sort of, it all happened in front of my eyes, but and of course I can understand the love for this stuff, because, you know, I'm a fan of other things, but Star Wars just isn't really my thing. And so that's films then.
Yeah.
And you said music. Well, again, it's funny, maybe this is because I'm old now and nostalgic, but The band I always really liked when I was a teenager growing up was the Wonder Stuff, and they actually put a new album out this year. So for the first time in a long time, I actually bought a CD, which was the idea of actually going into a shop and taking a CD up to the counter again. It's quite a nostalgic feeling.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed the new album because I think it's really got something of the feel of the older records.
Yeah.
And even though the only band member who is there from the original lineup is Miles Hunt, the singer.
Yes.
But of course he wrote the songs as well, and I think there was something about that and listening to that new album. Soppy romantics in this way, aren't we?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, another thing I actually like is just seeing the new episode of Red Dwarf.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel
good,
comfortable that you're you know, it's reminding you of an old feeling, isn't it?
Yes.
When it's done well.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably, you know, to put your finger on something which is, maybe this was it, the Star Trek thing, where I found it tricky because it isn't actually, it's like, it was close, but it can never be identical.
Yeah.
Whereas the idea of getting Chris Barry and Robert Llewellyn and Craig Charles and Danny John-Jules all back, there's sort of something about it which is very reassuring. And I found that also what we were saying with the Wonder Stuff album, that I thought, God, I could have listened to this in 1995, you know, if they hadn't split up the year before.
I feel like that with things like the new Divine Comedy album, just put it on and it's just...
Whatever it is, I mean, because we've all got our different tastes with music, film, TV, all of this stuff, but I think we all have a sort of sense of, you know, wanting things to be how they were at times.
Even before social media.
Well, it's funny with Doctor Who, because Doctor Who is something which we always change. So we're more used to the idea that Doctors change and companions and writers, director, you know, everything changes in that sense.
I was chatting to a friend the other day, and he'd been catching up with episodes on YouTube of the Mary Whitehouse Experience.
Oh, yeah.
And there's references in that into going into Owl Price and buying tapes and CDs.
Yeah.
And he said to me, you know, there's a whole generation now who just don't have to do that. They don't know how to do that.
I think whenever you look at anything where there's stuff you just wouldn't notice at all, there are things. When I was watching some of the older Goodnight Sweethearts, which of course is sort of mid-90s, you know, where there's sort of stuff where you think, well, that, you couldn't write it like that now because you'd just phone him on his mobile.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, why can't he get hold of it. But of course, I mean, mobiles, I suppose, were just about coming in, but it certainly wasn't the case that everyone had one. And so you realise that the whole structure of writing, and it doesn't have to be a sitcom, I think, you know, you look at drama or anything, you know, if you're writing The Bill or you're writing EastEnders or whatever it might be, you now can't have someone, we just can't get hold of someone in a way that, well, the first thing you do is ring their mobiles. There's a whole there's a whole type of situation which is now...
Twitter or Facebook. And then you go Twitter, Facebook, you know, if you can't get on there that way, you go...
They're friends on Facebook, you ask them. And
yeah, well, I suppose you... The thing is, if you couldn't get hold of them for all of those things, you would genuinely be, well, where are they?
Yeah.
Whereas back then, you could just, you know, there was that idea that if you weren't in touch with someone for... you know, for 48 hours, it was just because they were away. You know,
I see them in the pub.
Yeah, you didn't unduly worry. Yeah.
Now, because we sort of interact so much with people, it's like can't find well, and they start worrying.
I think it must have really affected, you know, sort of crime dramas and things like that, because you would often have that sort of situation where someone's being put in danger or whatever, and again you think, well, now they get their mobile out and phone someone. But of course there was always that case. Do you remember in Boomtown, I think it was, where they all get their phones out, and that felt very new for Doctor Who at the time. But of course they would, because it was set in 2005 or 2006 probably, because it was a year
now. That whole series is dated with a big computer,
but then it looks now mobiles. Oh yeah, whenever you see that, it's like whenever I see an old Jonathan Creek or something, and you think you've got these, the computer that people are using is this really old-fashioned looking thing.
Full boxes.
Yeah, isn't it funny how, you know, things change like that without you noticing until you go back and look.
Very true. Thank you, Tom. Thank you for that.
Tom Spilsbury has a charity very close to his heart called BUST. BUST, based in Bristol, England, UK. As a request, he'd like us to mention that charity, which is very close to his heart, has helped him and his family in the past. The website to contact the charity is Bust Bristol. That's bustbristol.co.uk. Please support them if you can, and thanks once again to Tom for speaking to us. Next time on the Target Files, we will be discussing the Trial of a Time Lord first story of that season, The Mysterious Planet, written by Terence Dix, and the audiobook release read by the late and great Linda Bellingham. Thank you, faithful listeners. We'll speak to you then.